Okay, so today I'm with Jack, and we are talking about cybersecurity and sort of strategy and sort of, from the perspective of how does the U.S. government, approach security in this perspective. So basically, within our InfoSec series, we've talked about a lot of layers. We've talked about how to hack and sort of to do tactical level exploitation, how to do strategic level stuff, and we've even sort of touched on the laws that affect companies and individuals, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, end user agreements, stuff like that. But we have never really talked about how a nation state secures its networks, and particularly the United States, particularly the United States, where I'm assuming most of our audience is. We've never really talked about it, and so today, Jack will sort of help us puzzle through, this issue of, what does network security, what is cybersecurity, whatever you want to call it, looks like at the government level. So I want to start off with, I was reading through your blog and reading through your a lot of the materials you have on your blog, basically PDFs, PowerPoint slides, whatever. It always comes back to NIST. Gosh, I should have written what NIST stands for in my notes, but describe what NIST is and sort of the role it plays in, network security.
Sure. NIST stands for the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They're a component of the Department of Commerce, and their job, not just in cybersecurity, but kind of throughout the country, is to set national standards, which is somewhat obvious from their name. If you work in the federal government IT security space, you've seen their NIST 853, security control catalog and things like that. And you've seen their standards in other areas of life. Right now, they're getting a lot of attention in the conversation, actually based on a White House directive that came out for cybersecurity. I believe it was January of this year. So to answer your question about NIST, I'm going to go back a little bit to the White House and to DHS and to critical infrastructure. Several years ago, a number of policies came out in the U.S. basically saying that we needed to protect our critical infrastructure from all hazards. That's terrorism, that's cyber attacks, that's all sorts of different hazards. And under these policy directives, cybersecurity began to be lumped in. The White House assigned DHS responsibility for, hey, go forth and make sure critical infrastructure is protected. DHS went and split off, the critical infrastructure industries in the U.S. into, manufacturing and energy and transportation, and those types of things. And they're formal designations in policy. And DHS came up with a National Infrastructure Protection Program, and so it's assigned each different agencies to each of the infrastructure sectors. So, for example, TSA is the sector agency for transportation. DHS does chemical. Department of Energy does, well, obviously, energy. And what this is by critical infrastructure, we mean typically privately owned infrastructure. We're talking about the need to make sure that the power stays on in the U.S., make sure the need to make sure that we can get people and goods can get from point A to point B safely, on time, and acceptable condition, despite terrorism or despite cyber attacks and the like. And so this went on, pretty much mostly untouched, except for some cosmetic changes for several years. And what happened this year, and we kind of knew it was coming for a while, was the White House was kind of, unhappy with how cybersecurity in particular in the U.S. was going under these mechanisms. And so, lacking any legislation coming out of Congress, it decided to order to issue an executive order. And now, an executive order can't change law. It can only encourage existing agencies to do more specific things under their existing powers. And so this executive order for cybersecurity came out and said, hey, you know, you guys have to do a better job. It's like a mom telling her kids, you know, I told you to clean your rooms. I left, I went away for a while, I came back, and sure, you swept the floor for about 3 minutes, but you threw all the toys under the bed and really didn't do a great job. So I'm going to be a little bit more specific and pay a lot more attention to what you guys do. And that's really what the executive order did. There's a number of, you know, pieces to it, but when it comes to NIST, one of the components was that the executive order wanted industry to develop, and by industry I mean transportation, manufacturing, chemical, you know, all the kind of utilities, the finance sector, to get together and create a national cybersecurity framework. And the framework was designed to help industry achieve certain, you know, some sort of performance objectives. Like, I think DHS used the example once, make sure that, you know, all 80% of cell phone calls are completed within 2 hours of a cyber attack. And I'm kind of, you know, making that was an example they made up. It's not a real one. But the point is, we're going to have an industry-developed framework. NIST's role in this is a little bit unusual. Typically, they're the ones who actually develop the standards themselves. They'll take input, but it's really their baby. In this case, the White House was very, very specific when it said industry is going to develop it, but NIST is going to manage it. And so this past year, we've had NIST running a series of workshops across the U.S. We're talking 400 or 500 people have shown up per workshop. It's basically open to everyone with, you know, a particular focus on, you know, critical infrastructure, asset owners, and vendors, particularly the asset owners, where those 400 or 500 people per workshop have gotten together and developed what is ostensibly a voluntary framework for cybersecurity in the U.S. And so that's NIST role, because they're used to standards development, because they're used to this level of coordination, has been designated that particular role. Interestingly, the implementation of that framework and all of the other pieces of the executive order have basically, with a couple of minor exceptions, fallen to DHS. And so you have two different civilian agencies kind of working on the executive order in tandem. NIST is doing the framework. DHS is doing the criticality development. They're doing the implementation of the framework. They're helping to solicit performance objectives, et cetera. So it's an interesting tandem role currently.
So where do we factor in? You've outlined the role of Commerce and NIST, the role of DHS, but where do we factor in NSA and the Department of Justice? I mean, basically, I guess I'm using the NSA as sort of a stand-in for the military, and the Department of Justice is, you know, law enforcement and sort of, you know, being able to enforce the law and sort of look at it from a sort of crime perspective. So, I mean, where do we factor in, you know, NSA and DOJ?
That's actually a really, really good question. One, I don't think we've actually sorted out the answer yet, but your question actually implied some of what the answer is going to be. And to maybe add some insight to it, it's important to understand that in the physical world, typically there's a bad guy, there's some sort of a target, and then there's geography in between the bad guy and the target, whether it's land, sea, space, air, you know, something. And so you can usually, the government can, when we're talking about, you know, protecting things, put, you know, their organizations and their personnel, their resources between the target and the bad guy. And, you know, this might sound obvious, but it has really, really interesting mission implications when we realize that cyberspace, and I hate that word, but nonetheless, it's in policy and law, so we use it. But cyberspace has gotten rid of that geography component. Your assets and your infrastructure, our private industry cyber infrastructure, is both the target and the geography. And so now we have suddenly those things that can be geographically separated before. You had kind of in the past, you know, the military handles, you know, threats coming into the U.S. DHS sort of handles national cohesion, you know, that border type scenario. The FBI does law enforcement inside, you know, on national issues. State and local handle response to, you know, very, very geographically specific areas. And so you actually had in the real physical world geographically delineated mission responsibilities in a lot of ways. There's obviously some overlaps, and you know, every generalization has exceptions, but that's about it. And now suddenly all of these different players have to go play in the exact same space that's also owned by private industry. And to your point, though, I think this is less complicated than some people are making it. For example, DOJ and FBI are a great example. Their mission is prosecute and convict. That's their legal mandate. I'm not a lawyer, but that's my understanding. I haven't heard anyone argue with me. Prosecute and convict is not necessarily a defend mission. And so if we're looking for law enforcement agencies to defend us, that's often in direct conflict with what their missions are. And I think the same thing goes very, very much for the military. We want to say, you know, hey, you know, military, you're in the business of defending us from foreign adversaries, but we're also used to the military not running our businesses for us. And as we collapse, you know, the geography into both target and geography and cyberspace, you know, if we really, really wanted the military and the NSA to take care of us and protect us from foreign adversaries, if we wanted to keep a completely hands-off approach and say this is above us, this is too much, we can't do it, then we're actually necessarily inviting, to some extent, the military and the NSA to put their hands on our businesses, to tell us how to run our organizations, how to build and install equipment, how to invest, and how to operationalize security. And so I don't think anybody really necessarily wants that. So we're hearing currently a little bit of both messages. Hey, you know, this isn't our racket. You know, you guys are the military, but we're also hearing a hands-off kind of conversation. And I think that's something that we're going to have to find some middle ground in the very, very near future. And I think it's still an open-ended question. The other minor comments I have on that are, to me, NSA is typically more of an offensive organization. Same with the military. They're not necessarily in the business of through offense. They're, in my mind, they're more through offense protecting us. I don't see the NSA having or even the military having the kind of collaborative partnership open approach that would be necessary to work closely with industry over time for general defense. That doesn't mean their insights and their capabilities aren't occasionally useful, but I think they would have very, very specific roles in very, very specific cases.
So I'm curious. I mean, it seems like there's a tension here between the public and the private, especially when, you know, looking at the public, because I think with private industry, you can, you know, it's a little more, you know, closed off conception. But with public, I mean, it seems like you have the Department of Commerce, law enforcement, DHS, which I will just say it's, you know, national cohesion or whatever, and the military. I mean, how does that work as a sort of policy space? I mean, it seems so muddled. And so, I mean, at least as an outsider, I mean, it seems like those four organizations are pulling in all sorts of different directions. Because, I mean, you even mentioned that sort of the military is an offensive organization. You know, the objective of, you know, DOJ would be law and order, or convict and prosecute, or prosecute and convict. And NIST is more for business. It's commerce. So, I mean, these are, you know, how do you sort of craft or, you know, tease out a policy between those four tensions, a public policy?
So I think what happens is you take DHS, who already has physical responsibility for cohesion, and their job really in every other space is, to some extent, their meta job is coordination. They have the public-private partnership mechanisms in place. They have the relationships in place. And more importantly, they don't have any competing missions. And so I see, you know, DHS's role as exactly what it's being laid out for. You know, some people have argued that they're not very good at their job, but that's a distinctly different conversation from whether or not naturally that's where the mission lays out. And I see, DHS maintaining its role as a coordinating function, as a partnership function with cybersecurity. And then in certain areas where you need more specific capabilities and missions, like in prosecution conviction, or when you need advice or skill or operational capability for offense, then you bring in, the organization that's designed to do that, like the NSA or the military. I think the confusion and the muddledness is more created by political play than actual reality on the ground in some cases. The way the policy is laid out, the way the organizations are running right now, even if there's a lot of potential disconnects still and, infighting, the high-level schema for how these all fit together, I think, is making sense at the moment. I would hate to see somebody dramatically change it. And partly this stems from the fact that I think a lot of people treat security as a kind of a magic black box, and, they don't really go through the trouble of categorizing or compartmentalizing different aspects to it. Part of cybersecurity at a high level is coordination. Part of it's, standards and, configuration. Part of it's, pen testing and breaking into things. So there's a lot of different mission spaces in cybersecurity. And I think once people are more comfortable and get more in the habit of realizing what those different mission spaces are in cybersecurity, the role the different government organizations will play starts to make more sense. The biggest disconnect, though, still is in how much we tell the government tell, and I'm not even in the government anymore, so I can't say we, but how much the government tells industry what to do and how much flexibility industry has. Within that scope, I think that there's more clarity of mission and roles and responsibilities than is usually thought. Especially a lot of the policy is public. It's very available, but it's written terribly. It's incredibly boring. And I'm not entirely sure the people who wrote some of these policies can even go back and read it. They're so pedantic. And so very often when it comes to, hey, what's going on with cybersecurity in the government? And oh my gosh, the government's doing this. With the exception of Snowden-y spy, type of stuff, a lot of what people don't realize the government's doing is because they haven't spent the time to go do the research, not because it's not clear and not happening. Just my opinion.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, I think you mentioned Snowden, and I think something that sort of, at least a debate, I mean, if we sort of tease out the non-extreme version of the argument, is that, you have the creation of the, communication system that is, that has two components of cryptography, of crypto, encrypting information and sort of, anonymity. And that seems to, sort of, run head on into sort of NSA's mission. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, is there a sort of tension between, applying state-of-the-art cryptography and securing communications across a network and sort of the larger mission of, of being able to, as the NSA, being able to be a functional spy agency and military organization? Or, and then moreover, does that sort of play into the tension between, securing communications for business, securing communications for the individual versus a military goal or an intelligence goal?
I think there's the tension that exists with that is within the space that it exists. I know that was a little bit tautological, but there's a lot more to securing critical infrastructure than cryptography and technology. In fact, I would argue that if I define what cybersecurity is at a national level, it would very specifically exclude anything to do with technology. So while there is a tension between everybody on the NSA's role, they're a spy, they're a secret spy organization that has built in tension. I don't think that necessarily does or has to conflict with the other overall efforts, which are much more about collaboration. They're much more about everybody working together to find a path forward. But that's a very, very good reason not to assign you know, responsibility for overall cybersecurity to the NSA, as, you know, I think, you know, has been made the case, at least in the media and perhaps Congress in the past, you know, because of that tension you mentioned. That's their job. It clearly conflicts with, hey, let's all just get along and find our way together. I think DHS is a much, much more appropriate role for that, or much, much more appropriate for that role.
So I want to sort of switch gears a bit and get into the concept of protection, right? So first, I mean, let's sort of define the term. You know, how do you define protection within this sort of, within, you know, cybersecurity? We keep using that term. I gotta find a new word, new phrase. But, you know, how do you define it, and, you know, how does it work now? I mean, is this really something at the national level? Is it sort of set of standards and a set of, you know, prescribed practices, or is this really something that's being enforced on everybody all the time? You know, how does the concept of protection work?
That's a really good question, and I have a pretty specific answer that you'll find people who will very, very much disagree with it, but I'm pretty comfortable in this. I think at a national cybersecurity level, when we say protection, it's a misnomer. I think we mean assurance. Having worked in there and looking at the way people are looking at what the state of play has been and looks like it's going to be, you know, we start out with a need for assurance much before we ever start out with a need for protection. And by assurance, I mean, if I'm the government, I need to know that some kid in China or some other Zakistan somewhere isn't going to blow up, or, you know, even Cleveland, perhaps, you know, or wherever, you know, wherever it may be. I need some assurance that I can, you know, continue to operate in the face of risk over time. There are many ways to achieve assurance: metrics, communications, you know, observation, many different ways to achieve assurance. One of those mechanisms is protection. In other words, if I have no other way to know that something's safe, I'm going to go protect it myself. And therefore, I will have assurance that it's going to be safe and secure, you know, to my level of satisfaction. I have a feeling that we're struggling with how to do assurance in cybersecurity. We can't have I've never seen a successful business metrics conversation that's universally agreed on by more than one or two or three or four organizations. And not that certainly not one that makes everybody happy. And so if we're looking at how to get national assurance that we're safe, with cybersecurity, or that, you know, figuring out which programs to put in place that would give us that level of assurance that everything's going successfully and keeping us safe, lacking that, and because we're having such a hard time with that, on one hand, that I think that's half of the reason we have so many protective activities. We have ICS cert, you know, we have people who are, we have concrete standards. You know, people want, you know, information sharing directly from classified government stores. Those are all kind of protectee type information or protectee type techniques. I think if we had a better ability to achieve assurance, we wouldn't need to do protection. The reason this is so important is because, you know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of critical infrastructure companies in the United States. That's a very resource intensive and very inefficient way of, you know, fixing things. Is suddenly the federal government is going to protect everyone in critical infrastructure from cyber attack. That's almost a nonsensical statement. And so we need to find a way to get that protection, that assurance, without having the government do necessarily that protection.
So I'm sort of curious, I mean, how do you define critical infrastructure? Because I was reading through on your blog, you have a post you did a DC B-Sides sort of explaining the difference between critical infrastructure and key resources, SCADA, and then control systems. So, I mean, could you, you know, help the audience and help me along with sort of separating out, you know, these three categories and sort of how the federal government approaches these three categories?
That's actually a really, really good question. And it actually is the second half of why I think we have an assurance problem. A lot of people involved in security are obviously super, super technical. I come from a hyper technical background. I'm a data analyst. I used to write open source code. And so, we have a lot of engineers, a lot of technical people who love what they do, and they're very, very good at it in the security space. And so many of us automatically, when we think of security, we think in terms of protection. And I am leading towards an answer to the other question. And so it was interesting. When I went and talked at, B-Sides DC on the CIICARA panel, as well as a couple of other, recent interfaces with a lot of people, if I'm talking to a security-specific crowd, they automatically assume I'm talking about some sort of technology when I talk about critical infrastructure. It doesn't even cross anyone's mind that there's more to critical infrastructure than SCADA or, control system, industrial control systems, which is, for those of you who aren't familiar, is kind of the meta term under which SCADA is one form of control systems. Medical devices are also control systems, but not SCADA. And so we have this as security practitioners in the cybersecurity world. It's when I say critical infrastructure, almost everyone I talk to goes straight to SCADA and gear and why are we hooking everything to the internet? And, these things are 30 years old. A lot of people fail to realize that finance is also critical infrastructure. They have almost no control systems whatsoever. And so a better way to look at what critical infrastructure is by realizing that critical is an outcome type of word. It's not an asset type of word necessarily. And so, especially in particular at a national level, critical infrastructure is that infrastructure, whether it's people, processor, technology, that enables us to function as a coherent nation. And so, when the federal government categorizes critical infrastructure into manufacturing and water and chemical and transportation and energy, they're not saying, hey, those control systems necessarily. They're saying, hey, getting power is really important to pretty much everybody. So let's make sure we can all keep getting power. And so when you're talking cybersecurity, you can't just think, hey, we're fixing some sort of vulnerability in some sort of Siemens gear hooked up to, a distribution station somewhere. It's more about enabling that industry to continue functioning. That could be HR systems, that could be billing systems, depending on how they're configured. That could be, hey, we need people to, start doing business a certain way to make sure that, these systems continue to function. And so, the cybersecurity part of it tends to be how it might be attacked. But the critical part of the term, critical infrastructure, is more associated with outcomes. And so that's a much, much broader term. Another consideration that's often lost is when we're talking critical infrastructure protection, there's a difference between, hey, I need to protect my organization today. I need to make sure that no bad guys get in today, and sustainable assurance that I'm going to be okay. And so when we add the word sustainable over there, that's not, hey, let's go patch our systems, or hey, let's disconnect every from the internet. Because what happens is if we take a completely technical approach to critical infrastructure cybersecurity, if we look at it only as control systems or computer systems and only as technical vulnerabilities, I could patch every system in the country today. We could fix every architectural vulnerability we have, every misconfiguration, and a week from today, it will all be broken again. And so when we're talking about, national efforts, these take, again, with the NIST framework, 400 or 500 people over, the course of almost a year all over the country to put together what amounts to a very, very simple control catalog. So if we just think in terms of technology and we don't address the broader definition of what criticality is, and if we don't address some of the broader, perhaps fuzzier vulnerabilities, such as education and awareness over time of key players, then we're not really doing a whole lot of good, and we're not really solving the problem.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, I want to sort of, and what you've described, it seems very much physical, infrastructure, computers being used, computers and systems being used in, dams and, what have you, and, critical infrastructure. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, where do we put data in this? And particularly what I'm getting at is, Krebs on Security, they had a story about Experian. So Experian is this sort of, it's a, they do basically they're a credit organization. And so for the audience, they basically aggregate everything and are one of the organizations responsible for your credit score. So this is involves a butt ton of data that they have. And recently they were severely hacked. And it wasn't anything that was digital. It looks like to be mostly a social engineering sort of scheme based on Experian would sell to other would basically package data and sell it to other companies, and this organization in Asia was able to sort of target one of these companies and get that data. So my question is, I mean, apart from infrastructure, I mean, how do we is the government responsible for protecting data, either in terms of physically sort of passing law, or not physically, but passing laws that say, you're limited to what a company can keep and for how long, or sort of increasing liabilities for the company, saying that, if you have a breach and you have a very large breach, you are going to be criminally liable. So, I mean, where do we put personal data and financial data, healthcare data in this sort of framework?
And that's a good question. I think there's a couple different answers. One of them's kind of reality at the moment. One of them speculative. In the specific case of the financial stuff, that would fall under, the finance is a critical infrastructure sector. So, their entire livelihood is in fact data. So when we're talking about the Experian breach, that's going to be addressed by the finance industry and any, critical infrastructure that's mechanisms that they have in place there. But the one thing we also haven't talked about is that there is also regulation in place for general protection. So, the electric sector has cybersecurity regulation, in place for many of its assets, because in addition to the policy framework that says we must protect critical infrastructure, someone else in the government, somewhere, everybody got together and said, we have a general safety issue. We need to, issue some sort of regulation. So there are other normal, as it were, legal and policy mechanisms by which we pass laws to protect individuals, and their data. So it's not right now a part of the critical infrastructure conversation at an individual protection level. The finance stuff itself would fall under the finance sector and be under critical infrastructure, but I think it's probably more applicable to say it falls under other policy, law, and regulation. That said, I think that we are, to some extent, missing people as a critical infrastructure sector. It would be fascinating to see, the general population be able to form, be recognized as a sector in and of themselves. Because right now it's very, very hard to bring individuals or groups to bear on solving this problem who aren't representing some sort of industry interests. There's a lot of very smart people working on the cybersecurity problem in critical infrastructure, but at the end of the day, at the moment, we all represent somebody's commercial interests. Or we represent an academic interest, or we represent the government industry interest. There's very few mechanisms in the larger critical infrastructure conversation to say, here's the interest and a perspective that the population has. And I think that the population, the citizenry of the US should be represented as a critical infrastructure sector. But that's not the case, and that's unlikely to happen. So, again, right now, normal people basically do your existing typical get your representatives to vote for whatever protections you want. And I'm, oversimplifying that, obviously, but I think you know what I mean.
I mean, that seems to be the individual protections sort of seems to be a gap, though. I mean, because, you know, I point out, I use the example of Experian because it just disclosed, you know, this week. But I mean, these sort of data breaches are, you know, strike me as common because there's a, you know, doesn't happen every day, but it seems like, you know, the large enough scale of data breaches of personal data, you know, not just from Experian, but from hotels, from, you know, online markets seem pretty common. So, I mean, isn't that a sort of risk, you know, as a black hat or as a hacker or whatever term you want to use? I mean, it seems like, you know, instead of targeting, you know, critical infrastructure, why not just target, you know, how a hotel processes personal data or how Experian processes personal data? I mean, does that sort of increase risk and sort of increase and makes it sort of the internet or how an individual experiences these networks sort of, you know, more risky? And, you know, it's to sort of add to that, you know, it's not risk that the individual takes on themselves, but rather risk that, you know, the company is not going far enough to protect that individual data.
And I agree with you, but I also think that right now that's not, on one hand, you want to protect the individuals, but it's not the purpose of setting critical infrastructure is to say, not those things which we should protect, but those things without which we cannot function as a nation. In other words, they become incapacitating to lose. And so, while yes, we should be protecting individual safety and individual rights, if everybody can't book a hotel room, then that's probably a finance issue. Then that's very possibly a finance issue, which would probably fall under critical infrastructure protection. But if we have a small group of people who can't, then their protection falls under the general protection to which the government should be affording everyone. If you understand the distinction, the criticality is really, if we can't do this, we can't be a country. And in order to protect individuals, we need to continue to function as a country.
The larger picture, the sort of
exactly right. And so it's important, but there's a functional dependency here on having power and travel and manufacturing, et cetera, in order to provide an environment in which individuals can be safe and successful and happy. But I think there can be a bit of a tragedy of the commons in that. So I do think we need better mechanisms for representing kind of the tragedy of the commons perspectives in the critical infrastructure debate. Especially when it comes to, you know, in addition to individuals, the infrastructure itself, you know, most companies come from the perspective of I'm protecting myself. The idea that there is a commons, that there's a common geography, that there's a common space in which individuals operate, companies operate, that we have to collectively take responsibility for hasn't really, I think it's permeating to some extent culturally, but I don't know many organizations that know how to or are necessarily willing to take on the problem of making the world a better place for everyone in the space of cybersecurity.
Well, I think for the sort of last follow-up, I mean, I think looking at court cases, it really does seem that as a sort of even mission-critical, you know, organization, that they don't go out of their way, but, you know, in the way they pursue court cases and sort of lobbying, that it sort of veers towards weakening these protections in the sense that it's easier for someone like Facebook or Google to access data and to move it around, to repackage it and sell it. Not that I don't think Facebook and Google actually do that. I think it's more like companies like Experian that sort of repackage data, sell it. So, I mean, this is more speculative, but I mean, do you ever see sort of these sort of consumer protections being enabled, or do you think it's just it's so profitable in moving data that really that protection, legal protections might never actually evolve, or is it up in the air?
I think it's up in there. It's hard. It's because, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago, and they were very much of the opinion that this will all sort itself out through, lawsuits in the market over time. And so I suspect that is a correct statement. I think these things do eventually balance out appropriately. The question is, do we have any, kind of triggers that make it too late for that long, lengthy, hard process to work through? In the greater critical infrastructure conversation, apps, I think we don't have the time for things to resolve themselves through kind of like lawsuit and market over time. We need to find a way to accelerate the process. I suspect the same thing is right for, the individual privacy, the individual rights, and the civil liberties perspective, especially on managing your data, is a dramatically different conversation, and one I'm much less positive and optimistic about than critical infrastructure. Critical infrastructure, I think we have interesting policy framework in place. I think will work over time. I think we just need some tweaks and some education to go on. I think we'll learn and we'll fix it. Privacy, civil liberties, the data gathering that goes on. I think that's an ugly, scary mess that we're in the middle of. So I don't know how it will go, but it's you're right to highlight it.
So, for the last bit of the show, I want to play sort of a mind game. So tomorrow, somebody from the Obama administration comes down to, the house, the apartment, wherever, and says, Jack, you're in charge of, writing, national security policy on this. Not national security, not like misspoke. National cybersecurity, that you're the guy who's going to write the eventual policy that will be enabled. So, I mean, when you approach this, what are some of the elements that you would put into, Jack's policy? What are, how do you conceptualize it? How do you think about it? And then how do you go forward with implementation?
It's going to be a deceptively simple answer, which is I would create a policy that actually appropriately frames the problem. I ask 10 people what the problem is. I get 12, 14, 15 answers. Right now, there's a lot of tribal knowledge being passed around. There's a lot of hearsay and gossip, and it's we're not solving at a national level a structured problem. We're kind of giving everybody together, and we're having a popularity contest over which pieces of the problem we think are important, and it's almost solving by mob rule. There are some very, very smart people working at it, but it lacks a coherent structure of this is overall where we want to get to. Here's what success looks like, so that if we don't, God, failure would be great. Having success metrics so that we can identify failure and adjust tactics would be phenomenal. But that's kind of a side note. Language, common structure of the problem, the clarification of mission scopes, those are things that I would like to see. We need an environment in which it is easier for us to derive good answers. So let me go back a little bit. One of the largest problems we have from a government and public-private partnership collaboration perspective, it is very, very hard to identify new good answers. There is a perspective right now by many, many participants in the conversation that people just aren't doing good cybersecurity, and they need to do better cybersecurity. And that if we just perhaps regulate them or clarify best practices, then suddenly things will get better. Whereas I really believe that right now, cybersecurity best practices are a list of things that by themselves don't work. If best practices that we have for cybersecurity worked sustainably over time, we wouldn't be getting the organizations who know better compromised like we are today. Experian knows better. Google knows better. RSA knows better. HB Gary knew better. And so we actually have not just a problem of people not paying attention and not doing, quote unquote, the right things, but we also, at a large scale level, we have a problem where we don't actually have the right answers yet. And what I'm afraid of is that we're going to go turn these answers, these best practices that don't work yet, into law, that we're going to turn them into regulation, that we're going to get everybody to do them, and we're going to expend the political capital and the political and cultural inertia and momentum we have right now, passing things and cementing things into place that just aren't going to scale and aren't going to sustainably reduce our risk. And so going back to your question and being more succinct, I would create a policy that clarifies the environment in a way that helps us derive objectives, goals, and plans for improving cybersecurity, as opposed to gathering and communicating existing best practices.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, you know, I think this comes up a lot is metrics, the issue of metrics. You know, how do you? I think it's come up in debate on Twitter, and it's come up in terms of damages. So in the sense that I think somebody was discussing the attacks on the financial markets, and they made the argument that, you know, the DDoS on the banks only cost the banks around 10 to, you know, maybe 5, 10, $15 million. You know,
right.
And the argument they made was, well, you know, that's really play around money for an organization like Wells Fargo, because they have a ton of cash on hand. And then somebody made the counter argument, which I found sort of fascinating, was, well, what you've really done is challenge the trust in the ability of the government to protect the banks, the ability of the banks to protect the customer. And so, I mean, in your experience and in your research, I mean, how do you define metrics, not only just for damages, but also for success? I mean, how do you, you know, what is a successful, you know, assurance and protection plan measure?
One that gets you something out of your program. I that sounds a little bit generic, but, you know, the idea that, well, one of the reasons that I think that communication normalization would be a big part of what I would suggest as a national strategy is because right now we've not managed to articulate what we want to get out of security for anybody. There are competing and complementary objectives. And so I don't think going to a metrics conversation right now is even remotely helpful. How can you have metrics when you don't have objectives? Metrics are measurements. They're not objectives by themselves. And so it's interesting that you have so many cybersecurity conversations, especially at a large scale level, go straight to metrics. Well, we need to measure better security. Well, you're never going to be able to measure better security. There is no such thing as better security. There's security that gets your organization something. There's, you know, we can make sure that we continue to make X amount of money per day, you know, despite somebody throwing X amount of resources at us to attack us. I can create some metrics around that, especially if I put metrics in terms of humans instead of technology. Waxing philosophic a little bit, maybe getting slightly off topic. One of my interests is in kind of creating a B-sides to the framework that NIST is doing. And as part of that, realizing that that your security state at a given point in time is an aggregate result of a bunch of decisions that people have made. And so if you're looking at large scale security, especially at a national level, you're looking at a rate of error problem over time. So you have a bunch of people making a bunch of decisions over time that get you into a security state you're unhappy with because it impacts certain objectives, like making money or reputation or something like that. And so at a high level, I would look at, once we develop kind of business, national and individual and international success metrics or success criteria, success objectives for cybersecurity, to start looking at which type of roles, which types of decisions are made that put those things at risk. And then we can start wrapping metrics around how we are managing and mitigating those decision trees that people have. So I don't want to put metrics around how many patches we have per month, or how many, you know, how much data we're sharing between organizations per month. I would like to see metrics around how well we are managing procurement departments when it comes to buying good equipment, or how well we are managing the difference between the need to get a product to market versus get security features enabled. Those are metrics that we can manage. Those are metrics that that will make sense at a business level, and that can be tied to objectives, while at the same time not being locked into, you know, a specific set of technologies.
So, I mean, when I was reading through your blog and sort of in the course of our conversation, it almost seems like, you know, what we have now is very much, you know, how to operate and tactics, but no real strategy or policy. I mean, is this, you know, is this a fault of sort of not being able to sort of promulgate interests across, you know, public, private, across different governmental institutions, there seems to be more of a comfort dealing with smaller scale, you know, tactical and sort of, you know, operational type things, as opposed to these larger issues of strategic, you know, conceptualizing a strategy and then conceptualizing a policy above that.
Both, but I think they're very much similar things. You know, we have probably one of the most helpful things I've done for somebody, you know, in a previous life, was there was a national kind of risk management life cycle for cybersecurity. And what I did was I split it into two. There are risks to computers and to cyber systems, and there are risks from computers and cyber systems. We're very, very, our security teams are very, very good at managing risks to computers. Or at least, you know, that's what they specialize in. Whether or not they're good at it or not is a different question. And so there's this tactical life cycle that goes on of let's keep people from getting into computers. And on one hand, I think we're given how many compromises we have, possibly failing at that. But what's interesting is we've done almost nothing with that larger life cycle, which is managing risks from computers. I went to a meeting. We had to do a risk assessment for a large organization in one of the critical infrastructure sectors, and they wanted me to come up with kind of a risk scoring system for it. And they brought all of their firewall guys and all of the IDS guys and their patching guys and their security managers, and I made them all leave the room, because I didn't really care how somebody was going to get into my computer today or tomorrow or in any other day that ends in a Y. What I wanted to understand was how their value chain worked. I needed to understand how their equipment was linked together to provide them value. Look at potentially if they were compromised, because it's very, very likely, in other words, probably a given that their network was going to be penetrated, because basically everybody's is. What were their risks from that penetration? And at a strategic level, how could we go about changing their business and, you know, validating that, you know, investing over time in ways that even if their network in a risks to perspective were compromised, the risks from were managed effectively. And that's something that just doesn't happen very well at all. Or if it does happen, they operate almost independently. There's a bunch of people doing large risk management type of activities, and there's people managing, you know, risks to computers and tactics and stuff like that, but they don't always talk, even if both are going on in the same organization. So yes, fully agree. We lack strategy. Patching more and patching faster isn't strategy. You can see it. One of the big red herrings in the critical infrastructure conversation is information sharing. It started information sharing, now it's real-time threat sharing. And I just hope somebody solves that fast so we can move on to a productive conversation. Because, you know, the way I look at information sharing and critical infrastructure is if you're a security guard at a building and you don't get to control, you have no access control mechanism for who comes in that's effective. You don't get to control where the windows are placed, whether they're open, whether they're locked. You have doors on every wall and you can't look at all of them at once. And all of that is taken out of your control. And which is how businesses operate today. We have very, very immature businesses that lead to, you know, tactical and technical cybersecurity vulnerabilities that if you have no other control, what you're going to do is go, can you please give me any information you have about who's going to attack me, when, and how they're going to do it? Because I don't have a generally defensible system. You know, 10 years from now, once most of our critical infrastructure problems are solved, the tactical, you know, helpfulness of, you know, real-time threat sharing will be incredibly valuable. But right now, we need to be able to have a structured conversation about what strategy we're going to have for creating generally defensible systems over time that kind of increases our strategic ability to manage to reduce the risks over time, as opposed to just keeping them out today.
So I think we've covered a lot today, but you know, the show's policy, we always let the guest have the last word and sort of last comment. So I mean, leave us with something to think about, you know, before we shuffle off. You know, leave us with, you know, what you think the audience should be thinking about this issue.
What I'd like to leave you with is that, you know, systems are, you know, when we're talking critical infrastructure, we're talking about cybersecurity. The protocol stack goes well above technology. You know, we have everything from bits and bytes on the hardware up through operating systems, up through applications, to data, to people, to organizations, to nations, to cultures. And so this is all part of the system protocol stack. And if you really, really want, if you're really, really interested in fixing things as opposed to just, you know, poking around at technology, if you want to make security better, you have to consider the entire full stack. And the second half of that is that, you know, I want to reiterate, the problem isn't solving things today. It's you know, as I said before, we could fix every issue we have today and we would still be just as vulnerable a week from now. And so, again, if we're talking about fixing critical infrastructure, we're talking about cybersecurity that has lasting national impact of value, then we need to solve the sustainability problems, not just the immediate vulnerabilities we have.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.